Listen up or run for cover. Dropping knowledge from the people who have it to the people who need it. The real dropping. Bradley Bombs is dropping.
What it is, Brad Lee back again with another episode of Dropping Bombs. Today in the studio, folks, I've got a real badass, as always, but this time, born and raised in Las Vegas, Nevada, Marty Cordova. What's happening?
How you doing, Brad?
And folks, if you guys don't know this dude, then you're not a baseball fan. The dude played for the Twins, the Orioles. He was Rookie of the Year, batted 309. I don't know the bunch of stats, but dude was a badass. Yeah. MLB baseball player for a long time, got into real estate, and I don't want to say invented, but started Bent Pixels, which literally, I mean, I don't know who started digital rights management, but that's a big thing.
It is.
Cause you know, people can, well, use Joe Rogan as an example. So you work with Joe Rogan and when his started, before it was even popular, then he started getting popular. How do you control the rights to all of those videos or audio tracks running around?
Yeah, and that's a super big challenge. And to just go back to what you first mentioned, Zephyr was the main competitor to rights management in the industry when we joined. They were doing all the movie clips. They actually had a channel called Movie Clips where they would take all the main Paramount, all the main Sony and those studios would give them clips, and then they would put them on a Movie Clips channel that was managed by Zephyr, hoping that people would then rip off those pieces of content, put it on their channels, which is a free way of marketing and all that, but then they had the software to then claim that video on someone else's channel, the ad revenue comes back to them, and then they rev share back with the movie studios.
Interesting.
So it was a great way to market, and that's the way we really work with Joe. Is as I was explaining that to his agent and him as well, is Joe, he was at one point getting 8 billion monthly impressions, and that's from thumbnails, or this are just people out there with user generated content that was not on his channel, that people were just seeing his picture or seeing his name in some form. And I'm like, that is, you don't have the money to pay for that kind of marketing. It would be way too expensive. So you're not only not paying for, but we're doing rights management for you. So I'm collecting revenue on your behalf. So you're making, I don't even want to say how much money, it was a lot of money, and you're getting all this free marketing. So, you know, it's hard for somebody to say, yeah, but I don't want this guy using my content. And some of the channels were like Joe Rogan fan page, or they didn't say Joe, or they'd say Joe Rogan, and they were trying to pretend like they were Joe. And some of them got up to as high as like 200,000 subscribers, 150,000 subscribers, and that. But a lot of the revenue was coming from that channel that we were claiming in behalf of Joe. And then finally he was like, look, I'm getting a little bit fed up with these guys, you know, these big channels, I want to take them down and try to drive traffic more to my own O&O. And so we did do that.
What's O&O?
Own and operated, his official channels. Yeah. Sorry, yeah, his Joe Rogan channel, and then Powerful JRE, and then Joe Rogan Clips. JRE Clips was his other channel.
Now, he's been podcasting for a long time.
Yeah.
And we would all agree that he's probably the king of podcasts right now.
Yeah, and I think it's everybody agrees that he's probably the number one podcast, and he's been for quite a few years now.
Now, other than because he's a comedian, he's cool, you know, but why do you think that is?
I think it's a combination of a lot of things, a few that you just mentioned, but he's also has unbelievable guests on there. He has some really smart people on there from all walks of life, all different topics and subjects. But what I like about Joe is he's just a really good interviewer. He's very conversational. He like if someone says like what I said, oh, and oh, he would do that. So someone would say something very scientific and then he'd go, well, say that again. You know, and it was seamless. You know, he'd break it down for the viewers to be, oh, I get that, I understand. So when there were super complex topics, the average guy like me, I could watch it and be like, okay, I understand it now. Joe's having him break it down a little bit into layman's terms. He's very good at holding conversations and the flow is great. Plus he's just a cool guy. He's a guy's guy. People like him. He's a badass when it comes to martial arts. He's great with the UFC. He's just a funny dude. He's earned his chops.
Yeah, and he's been around a long time. People think he's like some overnight guy. He's been around forever.
Yeah, and I'm going to mess up the name of the sitcom he was on, like Second City TV or something like that, way back in the day. He had a tiny little part. And then obviously Fear Factor was right where he got really famous back in the day.
Yeah. To me, like I didn't start this podcast to end up a podcast king or anything. I just had a lot of people coming in and out of this building because we create courseware for people. Tony Robbins, you know, Brian Tracy, Tom Hopkins, old guys that had big names for a while, new people that no one's ever heard of, but now they're big guys. So I just said, man, I got to pick their brain. So I'm going to get a couple microphones, have them sit down while they're here. And I started just doing the podcast, and boom, next thing you know, it's in the top 100.
Yeah.
And I'm like, well, shit, dude, might as well just keep doing it. So now 500 episodes plus later, we've got Marty Cordova.
And this isn't two microphones. This studio is really impressive. I had no idea what I was stepping into. Your office is pretty, pretty cool.
Well, thank you, sir.
Yeah.
I squander, in other words, I'm not frivolous. No, I'm frivolous. I'm not frugal. Mm. People are like, dude, you got stacked stone, you got freaking glass walls. It's like, dude, when people walk into an office, to me, it's like, that's their impression of you. Wouldn't you agree?
Yeah. It's first impression when you see us, how we dress, how we comb our hair, how we walk, everything. Yeah. First impressions, everything.
And it's a business. Like I want people to leave here going, dude, man, that guy's got something going on. Or I could be in a regular old office, cheapskate everything, have millions in the bank, you got no idea, and you leave thinking half of what you were thinking. So I'm always torn between should you show off or not. Now, you're buddies with a lot of celeb type people. Did you become buddies as a baseball player, or how did you start meeting? How do you meet Joe Rogan? How do you know Dana White? How do you know all these people?
Sure. Yeah. Good question. No, I didn't meet him when I played baseball, but I did, fortunately, through baseball, meet quite a few people. But how I met Dana was we've been knowing each other since we've been like 12 years old, 11 years old. He used to stay down at my house. We'd go, my parents had one of those trucks with a camper that went over the top, and we'd go rock picking. My parents are big outdoors people. He stayed the night all the time at my house. We just became.
Before he was.
We were the UFC freshmen guy. In high school.
So he's just a normal kid.
We were kids.
Was he a cool kid?
Yeah, he was cool. But see, then I was also friends with Lorenzo Fertitta, on the other hand.
Was he rich back then?
He was very, you know, not rich like he is today, obviously, but he was very wealthy compared to most people.
What about his parents?
Yeah, very wealthy. He was just a kid. I played Pop Warner football with him when he was 10. So, funny story about that is when back in the day, you know, we're close to the same age. When you had like a polo shirt with a polo brand, there was like a $34 shirt. And you're like, my parents like, you get two of those for the school year, that's it. And then their other shirts have to be something less expensive and all that. And I was like, okay, you know, it's all that my parents could afford. But when I played Pop Warner football with him when we were 10, you know, you wear your shoulder pads, and then you wear I'd wear an old beat up t-shirt, wife beater, whatever underneath it. He had a polo shirt underneath his pads. He'd take it off and he's got the $34 polo shirt. And I'm like, oh my God, this kid's so lucky. He's using it like as a practice shirt. And I was like, that's pretty cool. He's lucky to, but all that, Lorenzo has been such a stand-up dude. His whole family they're not like pretentious at all. They're very cool, down-to-earth people. So I don't want to give the impression that he was like spoiled kid, or that he, you know, was just had money dripping out. You know, it wasn't like that at all.
Yeah. And again, I mean, you know, he's done a lot for the community. He does a lot without even telling people.
Yeah, absolutely. And Dana the same. They both do. And I think that's the true giving nature is you want to give things, and there always is recognition for things you do, but they do a lot more. I mean, a lot more than most people know, and nobody knows.
I also heard you ain't getting a free UFC ticket though.
It depends on who you are.
Yeah. Cause like, dude, I hear those are like prized possessions.
If you're trying to go to the Apex, very hard, because it's not open to the public. You have to be invited. So those are very hard to get. And there's only maybe 20 or 30 people that he allows in there that are from his group.
And then you just get to watch the fight all by yourself.
Yeah. It's pretty cool. Cause you're in there. The Apex is a very small arena. It's made for TV, not for stands or for people in the stands. So you hear oh wow. I mean, these leg kicks, they look pretty, you know, painful when you're watching on TV, but when you see a guy get kicked and hear it, the sound, and then all of a sudden, almost instantly, you can see a bruise forming, it just gives you a whole nother respect for these dudes.
Are you in mixed martial arts?
No. I the only thing I ever did when I was in the minor leagues, I'm just being honest, I'm not the most talented person. I'm not 6'4", 220, you know, perfectly chiseled. So I knew I had to outwork my competition. So I would always be the first one there, last one to leave. And I had that mentality since I was young.
Who gave you that?
I guess probably my mom. My mom's like a crazy hard worker. She's 76 years old and she'll outwork most people I know. I mean, really, she's always been a crazy hard worker, and they've always taught me that hard work. You know, they came from very large families, very poor farm families. So they really valued a dollar in the work, and they've stressed that. So when I was playing in the minor leagues, I would come home and train with Dana. Dana was boxing, was a boxing instructor. He even was Floyd Mayweather's trainer back in the day before his, his father took back over. Yeah, believe it or not. And so I would train with him for 3 hours a day. We would do 3 minute rounds, 30 seconds off, 3 minute rounds for 3 hours. And it was a brutal workout, but it was so much fun. And I really loved to box. You know, I don't want to hit anybody or get hit, but I just like the training and it was just a cool thing to do. So yeah, that's kind of, I had this crazy work ethic and I was able to actually get a chance to work with Dana and work out all the time. So it was cool.
So back in high school, were you guys hoodlums or no?
We did our fair share of trouble, put it that way. Yeah, we did dumb things, you know, dumb drinking things, dumb stuff the kids do. But I kind of had two groups of friends because, like I said, I played sports, so I knew Lorenzo and those type of athletes as a young guy. And then when I went to Gorman, I was an athlete there. That's one of the reasons I went there. And then I met guys like Dana, who was an athlete. He was into wrestling and some other things, but he wasn't like a football player. It wasn't his thing. But yet we became really good friends because we were just normal guys. You know, we weren't rich and we just hit it off. And, you know, I had a real diverse group of friends. Some guys were sports, some guys that didn't even play sports ever. So it was really cool.
Did you make big dough playing baseball?
I made good money. I'm not going to say I didn't, but you know, compared to today's dollars, you know, obviously, and the guys before me said that too. Like I mean, it's public knowledge. The most I ever made in 1 year was $4 million in one season. The guys that played before me are like, dude, if I had my numbers and now today I'd make way more. And I'm like, yeah, I know, but I can say the same thing now today. If I had my career today, I might've made $150 million in my career. So
the
timing
crazy?
Is just everything.
Timing is everything.
And it's only getting better because the union for Major League Baseball is so strong that they've always negotiated that it was like a 51-49 split of the total revenue. So the owners get 51, the players get 49. So as the industry was a $2 billion a year industry when I played, now it's a $9 billion industry. You've got that much more salaries to split up. So guys, you know, the minimum was 109 when I played and now it's 750, I believe. So it's like, it took me 3 years after being rookie of the year to make 750. So times have changed and it's all, I'm so happy for the guys. I couldn't be more happy. I'm not one of those people that say, oh man, that sucks. He's making that. I was a way better player than him and he's made 10 times more money. I'm like, good for that dude.
Who's the local dude here? Bryce
Harper.
Yeah. Bryce Harper.
Yeah. He's a stud.
Like he's making what?
Yeah. He got a $300+ million contract.
300?
Yeah. But he made a lot before that. He probably made $50 million or more before that. So. Yeah,
that's just crazy.
He's doing good.
For playing a game that you love.
Yeah, it just tells you how, you know, there's only one right fielder for the Phillies and everyone in the world can have that opportunity to have that position. So you can say he's one of the planet. You know?
What do you think produces those? Because like if you look at Archie Manning, he didn't produce one Super Bowl winning quarterback. He produced two.
Yeah.
So like there has to be something.
There is, and I think there's a couple things. First, it's just good genetics. You know, they have good genetics. Obviously, produce one son that's a stud like that, you're probably gonna have a couple. But then also, a lot of the ball players when I played, well, for example, is Pat Mahomes Senior. I played with him for quite a few years in Minnesota, and Pat Mahomes Junior was in our clubhouse when he was 2 years old, walking around. He had his blonde hair back then as a little kid, cutest little kid running around. Had no idea he was gonna be one of the best football players to ever play the game. But my point is these kids grow up in clubhouses around major league athletes and it isn't then uncommon to them. Or like when I came up, I was like, major league seemed like miles away. I didn't know anybody that played. It was just like, seemed so unattainable. But for these guys, they're taking batting practice on a major league field a lot of times as they're getting older. They're around these guys. They see that level of talent regularly. So that it's just like you're growing up with being surrounded by so much talent and so much access to things that other kids just don't. So now when they go play with these other kids their age, they're just a whole other level above them. So I think it's a big advantage, not only the genetics, but also the experience you have being around the clubhouse, being around that atmosphere all the time.
Now, when you said, or when this article, it's not an article, my team does a little research on it. It says, when you're done with baseball, you return to Las Vegas and got actively involved in real estate.
Well, I'll piggyback off that. So when I was playing, a good friend of mine, Tom Santolio, he was business partners with him with Bent Pixels, and we've just been like family since we were little kids. Him and his father had Santoli Realty and Construction, and while I was playing, we were buying 5-acre and 10-acre pieces on industrial, and then they were developing over the years through a bunch of different partners. So when it was real estate, I was more of a passive investor, but I had all of that knowledge of these guys for years.
So you took money from baseball and said, I might as well invest it.
Yeah. I knew from a very young age that you needed to have some, you couldn't just have, no matter how much money you have, if you just have $10 million and you don't have any recurring revenue monthly, you're going to be poor at some point. It just the way it goes. Money goes a lot faster than you think.
And so I didn't learn that for a long time.
Yeah. That was beaten into me. Put it this way. I've never had a house payment in my life because my parents have always said, pay your house off. Don't have a house payment. Don't have. And I know that's not always the best advice when interest rates are nothing and you can do something else with the money. But then sometimes people do something else with the money, lose that. Now you don't have a house and you don't have money. So I'd always felt that it was beaten into me. Just pay your house off, pay your car. I don't owe nobody nothing, and I never will owe anybody anything. I sleep better at night knowing that I have a house, I have cars, I have money in the bank, and I don't owe anybody anything.
Feels good, though.
Oh, yeah. It's you sleep well knowing that. And it's not a crazy amount of money, but it's enough to where I can live a very nice lifestyle, and I'm not one of those people. I don't need to have jets. I don't need to have all those sorts of things. And one of the big reasons is because my friend's got them. So I just hang out with his. I'm kidding. But yeah, it is nice to
be friends. That's what they say is, what's better than a jet? Having a buddy with a jet.
Exactly. Yeah.
But we were talking earlier and you said you started doing not drugs, but drinking.
Yeah.
Both.
Yeah. That's a topic that I do. That's passionate to me. And it's one of the reasons why I sold my interest in Bent Pixels, about 90% of it. And then 100% of the spinoff company we had, Paladin Software. And the reason I did that is because I just wasn't passionate about that anymore. And about 2 years ago, I'd made a change and I'm like, I need to stop drinking. I unfortunately,
but you were a drinker.
Yeah.
Big drinker.
It kind of, and I've really never talked about this publicly. This is the first time I've ever said this where it would be a public thing. But growing up in Vegas, things happen quicker. When you're young, we drank a lot when we were little. We drank competitively. That was always fun. When you're young, to be dumb, we'd 18-year-old see how many, if you can drink 18 beers in a night. We just did stupid stuff like that. So drinking was always part of my social activities. But then when I was playing baseball, I was very dedicated to diet and all those sorts of things. So I didn't drink like alcoholic wise during while I was playing. I could just drink on the weekends, and then when I was home in the off season, I would never drink. I would just get in shape after January 1st. I wouldn't drink until spring training or whatever, just have a couple of beers then during the season. But as I progressed, drinking a little more, dealing with stress in certain ways, and I think it's hard for a lot of people to understand that athletes or successful people of whatever field they are, they just think that life's simple for them and that they don't have the problems that everybody else has. And in some cases, it can be worse. There's just a lot of pressure we put on ourselves as men, as athletes, as strong guys. You don't want to be weak. You don't want to show weakness. I feel like I'm responsible to take care of my daughter, my parents. I just want to do things and be there for everybody. And you put these pressures on yourself, and then you're playing a sport where you're failing 70% of the time and you're in the best player that ever played. It's dealing with failure. It was just hard to do, and dealing with these issues in your life, and then things add up, and then you're starting to drink too much. And then this kind of progressed more as I was playing. And then towards the end of my career, I was like, I really honestly was like, I needed back surgery. I had really bad back. I'm like, I didn't really care if I retired. I was ready to move on with my life. But that being said, started drinking a lot more then, and it became more of a habit. And then I was had a problem with pain medication because doctors would give you a lot of pain meds when you have back surgeries.
What kind?
Percocet, the 10s, the strongest ones, taking 12 a day, drinking a
12.
Ton. Yeah, bad news. And it just sucks your life. It sucks your energy, sucks your will, everything. It's just that, but it doesn't happen overnight. It happens progressively. And so it's just something that was, not a lot of people knew. A lot of people close to me knew. It wasn't something, that I wasn't I never got a DUI, never got in any trouble, never lost money or did anything like that, but I just drank way too much. Never got loud in public, never fought with anybody. It was more like medicine to me.
That's where I messed up. Because yeah. I used to drink. I still drink. I don't not drink, but I haven't drank in about, I'd say, 8 months or a year.
Yeah.
It's just, I lost the fun. And you wake up and you feel like shit. And it's like, you're going to lose a couple days if I go party like I used to. But I'd get drunk. Like we would be in a race to get drunk.
Yeah.
Like stupid. I can't even believe I do what half the shit I did.
I hear you. It's nuts. Alcohol is not a good thing. But again, I'm not judgmental. If everybody wants, almost everybody I know, I don't know anybody that doesn't really drink except a couple friends of mine. And I'm like, hey, drink all you want, do whatever you want. I don't judge anybody for anything they do. I have a ton of flaws. But if you need help, I'll be there to help you. I've figured out a way that I got through this. And
How'd you get through it?
Well, how I got through it was a few different things, but Joe Rogan was one of our clients, like I said, for 10 years plus, and he talked a lot about DMT, hyperbaric chambers, hallucinogenics, all that sort of thing. So I kind of got this calling to ayahuasca, and I'm not sure if you're familiar with that, sure. But you know, the listeners are familiar with it. It's pretty popular now and common now, but it's not a drug for fun. It's more like they liken it to 20 years of therapy in a week. When you go, I went to a place called Rhythmia in Costa Rica. And again, I had a really bad drinking problem and I was in desperate spot, you know, and then people are like, dude, you're not looking good. You need to get help. You need to straighten your life out. But to go to Rhythmia, you have to stop drinking. You can't drink and you got to be completely sober, and they want you to be eating healthy for a month because you're going to purge a lot. And that was one of the reasons I didn't go for a while, is because I just couldn't stop drinking. So then finally I made that, you know what, I'm done. I was done. I'm like, you know, I need to stop this. I know it's medicine. I don't enjoy it. Like you're saying, I had no fun from it. I wasn't funny, or I wasn't cool, or I was nothing. It just did nothing for me, but I had to drink or I would get shaky. It was just a terrible thing. And anybody that's
straight up alcoholic.
Anybody that's listening would know, but I
never got that way.
I didn't wake up in the morning like to drink, but if we were going to the beach, I'd be drinking at 11 with everybody else. But it wasn't like I woke up and drank, or I went to work and drank. I could always wait till 5-6 o'clock. But if that time I started getting like, I'm going to get sick if I don't drink. And it became...
You must have drank a lot, though.
A lot.
Because I wouldn't drink every day. I would drink like every weekend.
No, I drink every day. I couldn't miss
a day.
Is
that what gives you the withdrawals?
Yeah.
Because I never had withdrawals.
Because you're not an alcoholic. And you see that. So whenever I have a conversation with somebody that's not alcoholic, they're like, they don't get it. But then when somebody that is, they're like, yeah, I don't even... You don't got to even tell me more. I understand. There's different levels, and I was more of like a functioning alcoholic. I could, nobody really would know. I could drink and not, like I said, I was a very mellow person.
Would you drive drunk?
Never.
And see, that was my dumbass did.
Let me say, back up. Of course, I drove when I was drunk many times when I was younger, because I was an idiot, and you just think no one's going to catch you.
And you're not that drunk when you're drunk.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, you don't think you are.
I'm not that drunk.
I'm good. That's what everybody says while they're getting cuffs put on them. But now as the Uber's opened up, it's really been a blessing for a lot of people, because there's no excuse now. You can leave your car. You can jump in an Uber. It's when I was living here before Uber, I lived in Anthem Country Club, and it was like, nobody wanted to take you home. I'd be drunk in the taxi line, get to the line, they're like, where are you going? I said, what does it matter? Like, wouldn't let me in the cab. Where are you going? I said, Anthem Country Club. That's out of zone. I'm like, what does that even mean? He's like, "We I don't want to take you there. Like, you don't get your choice, because I know you want to go to a strip club, so you get $40 a person that goes there, but that's not how life is. I'm trying to not drink and drive. Dude, please, just take me home. And it's got, almost every time I went out, it was confrontational like that. So I was like, Uber's amazing. It's... I would have thought it would drop the DUI in this type of level significantly, but I'm not sure if it did. But
it has to have.
Yeah, you think it would, but I really don't hear people talking about that too much. It's like, you know,
well, if you drink and drive with Uber, you're a stone cold idiot.
Yeah,
and you deserve whatever happens to you.
Yeah, unfortunately,
one time I was driving down the strip, dude. I came here in '91, just for a visit. Blew all my money. Had to stay, get a job. If you've been here your whole life, you'll know exactly what I'm talking about. There was a restaurant on was it Sahara? I'm not sure. It's called Fratelli's.
Fratelli's.
Remember Fratelli's? It was like on Trop. Maybe it was Tropicana and like Eastern.
Right, that's there. I was the west side of town, so I'm not familiar with the East. That was a big, like, East and West were.
Yeah, so I got a job there just so I could get enough money to get back home to Oregon.
Yeah.
And then I started meeting people. Next thing you know, I lived here.
Yeah.
So, but we used to drink like a son of a bitch. I got a couple DUIs like a dumbass. But one time I'm thankful I got pulled over, because I might've killed somebody. Mm. Like, I was driving with one eye open down the strip.
Yeah.
Trying to freaking, you know,
stay in between the lines.
Stay in between the lines. And then I saw a cop behind me, and obviously, you know how your gut drops. Yeah. So my gut drops, and all I did was to turn into the Imperial Palace. It was Imperial Palace at the time. And so, and when I turned in, dude, if there was anybody going across, I would have smashed them. I didn't even look. Cop car, panic. Turned in. And thankfully, there was people on both sides, but nobody in front of my car. And I rolled in, stopped, got out. They arrested me, obviously. And I never, ever drank and drove again after that.
Yeah. Like sometimes that was my it's lesson. A lesson and you're lucky, but imagine if you hit people, it's a lesson that you might still be in jail over. Well, you know,
it would have been a different story.
Your life.
Yeah. And there's people that have accidentally hit people and, you know, yeah, it wasn't necessarily their fault, but it was their fault.
Yeah.
They made the choice.
Yeah.
You know, obviously nowadays, if you're drinking, call a freaking Uber. Like, dude, if $40, $50, $90, how cheap is it for an Uber compared to a DUI?
I think a lot of it is, it isn't the money in a lot of cases. I feel like it's, you're drunk. You're not the same person you are sober when you're drunk. A sober person would say, "Why? I will never get in the car when I'm drunk. What are you, stupid? I'd get in the Uber." That same person will get in his own car and go, "I'm not that bad." Because
that's what I do.
I got to come back and get my car tomorrow. Well, I got work in the morning. I'll make it home. Okay.
Mine was always, I'm not that drunk.
Yeah. Yeah. Famous last words.
Every time you're drunk, you're not that drunk.
Yeah.
But fortunately I learned. So how did you learn? Cause again, I guess I wasn't an alcoholic. I just, the last time I drank about a year ago, polished off about 6 bottles of Camus Special Select, which is great wine.
Yeah.
With a couple of friends, my wife and a couple of friends. And by the end of the session, I was basically telling them all to go fuck themselves. And the girl's a bitch. And, you know, I'm like, and, you know, whether I was right or wrong is irrelevant. I was drunk. I was obnoxious. I was belligerent. And I embarrassed the shit out of my wife, who's a sweetheart. Yeah. So I woke up the next day and I could just tell like, she's tired of this. And so I just said, I won't drink anymore. She said, yeah, right. And I said, well, I will drink if I want to drink because I'm not going to drink, but I won't ever get drunk like that again. She said, I hope not. And so everybody forgave me and I haven't drank since. Cause nice. It's like, dude, if in my mind, why drink at all if you're not going to get drunk? Like I drank to get drunk. I don't like the flavor. Do you?
No, I don't think really anybody. I guess maybe some people like whiskey, but I defy them. It's maybe an acquired taste, but it's like beer. Remember the first beer you had? You're like, you got to get used to it. It's not like you like it. You almost just get used to it. And then even vodka, nobody likes the taste of alcohol.
Hell no.
If they do, I mean, that's probably a problem. But I guess whiskeys and wines are a little different because they do have flavor and you're just sipping them or tasting them. It's a little different.
So you said, let me go do ayahuasca.
Yeah.
And that's what cured you, you think?
No. It isn't. And back, I won't get into this because I want to talk about after ayahuasca, but probably 2017, 16, a good friend of mine, he had recognized that I had a problem and he was kind enough to like, dude, you got to get help. And he's like, I'm like, I think I'm okay. And he's like, just give me a week to try to stop drinking. And he's like, you got a week. And then I was like, try to just drink beer and it just made me almost crazy, almost lost my mind. And I was so stupid to do that because you can kill yourself. You can have DTs and die from when you're consuming large amounts of alcohol. So he came back in a week and I'm like, look, I'm ready to go. So I just didn't want to fight it. I just knew that it was time for me to just stop the madness. It wasn't any way to live. I was just not totally unhappy. And then I didn't drink for like 4 years. My daughter was in a tragic car accident and almost died. And that was right when I went to rehab. And so thank God I was sober enough to be there in ICU for her. And she was in a coma for over a month.
Wow.
And so I think that it was not just an accident that my friend came over at that time. I think it was, you know, it was put in play by, I believe in the higher power, you know, whatever that may be to whoever, you know, whatever you think it is. But obviously there's more than just what we got going on here. Mm. So yeah. So then I went to that rehab, got done. And then, you know, as it goes, 3 years go by, 4 years. And I just started, I'll drink wine a little bit with the new girl I was dating. And then next thing you know, it got back into drinking and drinking again. And then it just got back in the same a couple of years later. And then that's when, like I said, about 2 years ago, I decided that I needed to, this, I was done. I'm like, I'm done. I got to make a change in my life. What's really sad is during the pandemic, I had a really bad sore throat and I looked at my throat and it looked terrible. And I was like, if this is cancer, great. I just want it to be quick. You know, I really didn't care. It was that bad. In my place, in my mind. And so I was so ready to just go ahead and I need to make a change. So the pandemic had brought out a lot of this. I'm like, I got time now. I just want to change my life. I was contemplating what I was going to do with, like I said, my career with Bent Pixels, that it wasn't making me happy. It wasn't making me content. It wasn't passion where I got it. I had nothing. I had no passion left in me. I played the guitar 25 years and I hadn't played it off and on for many years. Cause you drink and you look at your guitar and you're like, yeah, I'll play. And then tomorrow. And it's always tomorrow. You know, that's how it goes when you have someone drinking too much, it's always tomorrow. And then tomorrow never comes. So I'm like, I need passion back in my life. So I did the ayahuasca. Fast forward, my birthday's in July. I went to Tulum and I did Bufo, which is a toad poison, and you smoke it with a shaman, and it's not a fun drug, believe me.
Is that the DMT?
Yeah, there's nothing fun about it. It's a very deep experience. You go inward.
Is that the God drug?
It could be.
Or what's it called? The God drug?
It may be. I'm not sure of any nicknames of this, but Bufo is just, there's different hallucinogenics. It's one of them. And I just kept looking for answers. Like, what is my purpose in my life going to be? What, you know, I kept doing that. And then as these experiences, what came to me was stop looking outside of yourself, look inside yourself. You have the answers. You just keep looking in the wrong places. So I took that to heart and I really started working on myself then, doing breath work every day. I never meditated before. Now I meditate every day. Like I said, breath work, cold exposure. I started doing that Wim Hof training. It's funny how I ended up, backtrack just a tad, is going to do the ayahuasca. I said, like, this stuff calls to you. I didn't really know what it was, but Joe Rogan was an influence. And then Dr. Joe Dispenza, he is an author, and he talks about the exact same thing ayahuasca does, but he does it through natural DMT, through meditating in your mind. Mm. And he even admits that ayahuasca is the same thing, but it's more of a shortcut to doing what he does, because his takes years and years and years of practice to get to where you can translate, you know, leave your body in a sense. And so I had all these things going on around me. You know, he was in my network and I didn't even know really who he was. And so I started reading all these books, doing all these things. And then when I did the Bufo, again, I came home and I'm like, okay, I got exposed to Wim Hof, and I was doing, I'm not sure if you know who he is. He's the Iceman. Sure. And I started getting a cold exposure, started doing these different things and just spending like 6 hours a day, at least, reading, studying, meditating, doing all these things, because I just was still in a bad place recovering. You know, took time to recover from this. You just don't go from being under the influence like that to just being clear-headed. It takes months and months and months of hard work and dedication, and I was willing to do that, put in the work to do it every day, and know that I just got to keep moving forward. You know, it's not perfect, but it's going to get better every day. And I have that work ethic. So I was like, just continue to do this. I journaled. I took immaculate notes of what I'm doing so that I could look back and be accountable. So I'd say, look, if I missed a day of doing something, it'd be like, okay, I'd missed. I can't do that anymore. It just really helped me be accountable. So then started then talking to different people around about what my future would be. And then I decided that I need to help other people. That's the only way I'm going to really be happy, is by being of service to other people. And I really wanted to help other alcoholics in trouble, or people that are like, there's wellness centers out there that are for people that maybe aren't full-blown alcoholics yet, but they may be executives or athletes or whatever. They have some sort of a problem and they just need to get away for a period of time before they go to that next worst level. And it's a place where you do that infrared saunas, cold exposure, breathing, meditation, hiking, all these sorts of things, of just ways to just figure out why you're doing these things. Because at least for me, why am I drinking so much? You know, obviously it was something that I was unhappy in my life about. You know, you're just trying to kill that part of you. You just don't want to deal with it. So to me, you really, if you don't figure out what that is and start to delve into your problems, and I know I'm not saying any groundbreaking things, but it's hard when it's you. It's easy to say, but when you're doing it, you know, I got to figure out, why am I doing this to myself? You know, what don't I like about myself? So you got to do a lot of deep soul searching, and this meditation and things really helped me with that, to try to figure out, you know, why am I so unhappy with my life when things are going so well? It just makes sense.
Well, that's a perspective a lot of people don't have, though. Like I agree with you. Why am I doing this? There must be something. But some people, like I've asked, you know, why would you do that? Their answer is, it's fucking fun. I fucking like it. I like drinking. I love drinking. And they're not thinking it's a punishment. They're thinking it's a reward. What would you say to those people?
Well, I'd say maybe those are people. It was fun for me at some point. Drinking was fun. It's fun for a lot of people when they're not an alcoholic and when they're just drinking to have a good time. Great. A lot of my friends, everybody I know does that. They go out and blow off steam, have a good time, but then they don't get up in the next day and feel like they need to drink again and continue to do that. So to me, there's a difference between somebody, even like a person that drinks a lot every weekend or a couple week times a month, and there's people that occasionally drink, but then there's people that drink every day. And the people that are drinking every day and are truly alcoholic, there's something deeply wrong, you know, that they just don't understand yet. And that's what the ayahuasca really brought out, is it brings out, like, you go deep into trauma in your life, and there's 70 people at this place, all that are trying to figure out what is going on in their life. They're there for similar purposes, whether it be some women had some sexual assaults, one woman lost her son in a car accident, a young teenage boy. There's some 75-year-old couple that were there just to get more spiritual. It's just all across the board, some drug addicts, some this, some that. But at the end of the day, everybody's trying to figure out what is the reason why they have this self-destructive behavior. And to me, I don't want to fix a symptom. I want to fix the problem. So if you take depression medication or this, you're just really masking the symptom. And it's like, well, why do you have the depression? And that's, I think a lot of people don't want to dig into that, and it's hard, or that it takes work, or maybe they're just like, I'd rather just take an antidepressant medication and get through life. But I'm realizing that's not the way I wanted to live. I wanted to be off of pain medication, drinking, be clear of mind. My focus is better. My thoughts are better. Just the way I deal with people is better. My interaction with other humans. I enjoy talking to people. Before, I wouldn't isolate, not talk to anybody.
What do you think between the two was more enlightening?
Of the Bufo or the ayahuasca? I think they're both different in their nature, because the ayahuasca is, you do ceremonies, you're there a week, but you do four in a row on Monday through Thursday, and it's 12 hours the first three nights, and then like 16 hours the third night. And then
I've straight tripping balls.
Yeah. And you, it's not fun. It's torture. It really is. Cause you're there to break down your ego and to get back to that childlike kid you were, that your true essence of who you are, not this ego, not this thing you've developed, not this armor you've put on, and this fake person that you're pretending to be.
See, what I have, because when someone says, let's go do ayahuasca, I always think no, and they say why, and I say, because I don't want to shit myself.
You don't.
You and don't. That's ego.
You don't. And it also, too, it's like, you know, people say things, this and that. It's part of the experience.
What do you mean people say things?
People will say, like, oh, you shit yourself. You know, you, it's not that. You know, people just hear things.
But you
do
shit yourself, don't you?
But you don't shit yourself. That may happen one time in the whole 4 days to one person. You know, when you're going to go to the bathroom, you get up and you go to the bathroom, but you're going to go to the bathroom a lot. And it's
good. Oh, I thought you take this medicine and all of a sudden you start puking and shitting and tripping.
No, I'm not even.
And I've tripped. Accurate. I've taken acid before.
This is a little different, because it's not, it's a ceremony. It's, this has been around for 10,000 years. It's an Indian thing. And so
Mother Ayahuasca comes to visit.
It is. It's the female version. Iboga is the male version, which is much stronger.
Is Boga the Bufa?
Iboga is, no, it's another type of ayahuasca, but there's ayahuasca and Iboga. They're just the female and male versions, but the male one's way stronger. It's not meant for first time people. It can be really hard on them. But
between the two, which one did you get more enlightened feeling?
I got more out of the ayahuasca because of the length of it and because of what bad shape I was when I did it. Because it really jolts your system, and it's just too hard to explain the changes in people. There's 70 strangers that go in there. Maybe a couple people know each other. But I've seen changes in people that were there that were amazing. What people that were angry or this way, and then it just completely melted away. You lose all judgment. You lose all anger and hatred towards people or towards yourself or towards whatever. I probably cried for hours a day. It was just, you know, it's...
Did anyone go with you?
I went by myself.
Is it advised you go by yourself so nobody sees you crying?
No, it's not that at all. It's not that at all. The reason why you don't want to...
It's my ego talking.
Yeah, exactly. That it really is your ego talking there. Because that, I don't care. I cry in front of anybody right now. It doesn't make me less of a man or a person. I don't care. It's just, that's what got me in trouble, is holding these emotions in and acting like I'm something I'm not. You know, I don't want to be a fake person. We all cry. We all have, you know, sadness, and we all experience these feelings, but that's really all they are, is feelings and emotions. They're not something that you should be ashamed or afraid to express. So yeah, the reason why you don't want to go there typically with your wife or say your family member is because a lot of times you're more concerned about what they're doing than working on yourself. And that's not at all why you're supposed to be there. You're supposed to be there for yourself and not be distracted or worrying about something else, or because that's a big problem. There is a lot of times there's examples of somebody that's on the outside is screaming and moaning and going crazy, and you think they're possessed by the devil. And then they'll do this for 10 hours straight. And sometimes they have to be taken off by the shaman, and they do all these things to try to calm them down. And then the next day people are like, oh my God, you had the worst trip. And he's like, what are you talking about? It was amazing. I talked to my higher spirit for 10 hours. It was the best experience of my life. So the point was, what you see on the outside is not necessarily what's going on the inside. So you're better off minding your own business and taking worrying about yourself, or you miss the experience is what, I guess what I'm saying. So I wanted to go there with no worries about anything but taking care of myself and trying to figure out what, you know, straighten my own life out.
And then the toad juice, that what I hear is like the second you take that,
it's instant. It's similar to what I liken it to is when you, I just had an injection in my back a week ago, and you get this light when you don't get heavy sedated, you go under, but you're not like fully incubated. It's like that, but it's not like you go there, you're in a teepee, you're with a shaman. You're not there for fun. You're there because you're trying to figure out what's going on with your life, and you're trying to figure out how to better your life. And it's not enjoyable. So you sit there with intention and you talk to him, and I have about 20% Native American in me. My dad's like 40%. So this was in Mexico. It's a very Native American thing. Ayahuasca or all these sorts of things are. So this dude was Mexican, and we just had a really good conversation, and he did a lot of like chants and things in Native American stuff. And you smoke it. And when you smoke it, you just breathe it in like 15 times. And then the last one, you just deep breath. And it's really similar to when you go under surgery, you just go down, you start to just black out. Next thing you know, who knows what happened, but you lay down, or there's a pillow and you lay it down, and then you sit up. So, you know, he'll lay you down because you can feel him like lay you down. And then you're just in another realm. You're just not really sure what time is or space, but I could hear him talking and I could hear what he was saying, but I really had no, concept of time and space. It's hard to explain, but it wasn't like fun. It was just because I was there trying to figure out, you know, like I said, what's going to make me happy, what is my purpose in this life. And he's just, again, playing music, doing these things. It's 20 to 30 minutes, but you wouldn't know whether it was 2 minutes or 2 years. And then you just kind of come to a little more, and then he starts to tone the music down the same way they do with ayahuasca. They run you through songs every there's like 5-10 minute songs, and they have a purpose to either agitate you, to calm you down, or to wake you up or put you to sleep. That you go through these cycles, and a lot of it is, especially with ayahuasca, is like torture. They'll play a song and there'll be a note that's out of tune, and it's like ding 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 ding, and it's like you're very uncomfortable, you've thrown up, you've went to the bathroom a bunch, you're sweating, you're totally and now this is like makes you want to run out of this myoka, where you're, it's like a dojo that you're, all these people are in, you're just so uncomfortable. But that's the point, they want to make you uncomfortable, they want you to be, it's got to be tough, right? So I guess when you talk about going to the bathroom and throwing up, it's like breaking down of your ego. So to me, I kept saying, I'm open for this. I'm surrendering. I just wanted my ego to go away. You know, that was the goal of this, and to be reborn in your youthful young self, that your true nature. So, but I think it's when you think you're doing something and trying to do something, it's really your ego working, and your ego doesn't want to go through this torture to go away. So I know this may sound crazy, and if anybody hasn't done ayahuasca or know about it, they probably think I'm a lunatic. But if you've done these types of things, you'd understand what I'm saying. It's not crazy. It's reality. It really is happening. And so as you are going to the bathroom and you're throwing up and you're doing this, you can just feel like you're starting to really surrender. You're really like, you can feel your ego's going. You're not putting up any fight anymore, but it does take a lot to break you down. Some people within an hour, they'll have this experience of their ego dying, and they're being they all similar type, you'd say the death of an ego, and then rebirth of your true self. And everybody describes it a little differently, but it happens to about 90% of people while they're there. Some people on the first day, some on the last day, some people they go home and they'll have it like 2 months later, but majority of people have it there, and it's just different levels of how you have it.
You plan on doing it again?
It's funny you say that, because you create bonds with these guys that you're there with, because it's like you're going through war. It's like really like you've gone to war with people, and you become close in a way that you can only relate to those people as. And I felt a calling to do at the time I did it. It wasn't fun. It was, I needed it. I just felt drawn to it. It happened. I actually did it for a week, talked to one of the shaman, and I felt like I maybe needed to stay longer. And then we talked a little bit, and then they talk in riddles. And then he's like, why wouldn't you? And then I gave him some dumb reason about the vaccine. And then he's like, without telling me, he's like, you stay. So I stayed there a week in country and just kind of assimilated the, of what you know, you're like an open vessel, you know, everything, the noise is loud, everything's so much more intense. And so you just kind of decompress for that week. And then I went back and did it another week. So it was 2 out of 3 weeks. It was really super intense of an experience. So that being said, to answer your question, is they kind of say some people come every year, like once a year, to do a cleaning. But and then one of the guys I was pretty close with, he's like, do you want to go back? And this was like in May. And we talked about this like 6 months ago. And I said, I don't feel the need to go back. I don't want to do this just to go do it. It's not something that's fun. It's not something that's recreational. It's a purpose for it. And I feel like if I don't need it or feel like I need it, then I'm not going to do it. So I told him, I'm like, look, I may go to Costa Rica if you want to go, and I'll surf with you because it's cool there and I learned how to surf there. So I'll do that, hang out. It's a beautiful country. But I'm not just going to do ayahuasca just to say I did it or because you need a yearly checkup. I don't think it's for me that way anyway.
Hmm. So that, in to your belief, is what said, okay, I'm done drinking. So now you're done drinking.
Yeah.
And you said that was only 2 years ago.
Yeah.
So like if I'd have met you 5 years ago, you were a drinker.
Yeah. 3 years ago, I was a drinker.
Did any of your friends say, dude, I don't like you anymore because you don't drink?
No, because I was just a nice guy. I have such a mellow personality that I never got loud. I didn't fight with anybody.
But I mean, sometimes you get people have friends, and as soon as you decide you're not going to drink, some friends decide not to hang out with you anymore. Why? Well, because they want to drink.
Yeah.
And so now, oh, freaking Marty ain't drinking. You know, hey, let's go. Someone call Marty. Let's go out. No, don't call Marty, dude. He don't drink.
Yeah. Unfortunately for me, we're not 20 and we don't have immature friends like that to where they're like, you know, beer pressure, drink. You know, my friends are like, dude, you need to do what makes you happy. And if you got a problem drinking, don't drink. So nobody, all my friends are solid. They're supportive of me. They're like, they're 100% like, is it okay if we drink? And I'm like, dude, do whatever you want.
What would you say to the listeners that aren't necessarily got the best of friends?
It's tough though. That's why a lot of times when you go to rehab or you stop drinking, you do have to separate from drinking friends. You do, because they're going to pull you right back into it.
Or make you feel less than, yes, because you don't want to drink. So now you're not fun.
Yes.
And then again, drinking makes you fun, supposedly. Yeah.
And there's friends like that. And your misery loves company. And so somebody that's a drinker wants you to drink. And if you say you're happy and you don't want to drink, they want you miserable and they want you to drink. It's just, so you have to separate yourself from those people. And thank God, and fortunate for me, is I don't have a desire to drink. I only drank because I had to. I don't want to do it. Like I was alcohol in my freezer. I just came back from Miami with Dana and his son's 21st birthday. And all these guys and friends were drinking, having a great time. And I had no problem at all just getting completely having fun and doing everything, because I don't need to drink now to have enjoy myself. Because I think I've kind of gotten a little bit more, I guess I was a very insecure person. And so a lot of times people that you think maybe aren't insecure are the most insecure. And so I would drink to try to fit in, or maybe, you know, take the edge off, or that's what I would think. You know, and so now I'm like, I don't really worry about that. I'm not so concerned about how I look or act or this or that as much as I used to be. So I'm not so concerned. Like a lot of times people drink, they're self-conscious, or they don't feel like they fit in, or everybody's drinking and they're not, they don't know what to say, or you know, it's just uncomfortable for them. But luckily for me, I don't have the desire to drink. I can fit in with my friends and hang out and do everything just as if I was drinking.
So what are you focused on now?
Well, now again, like I told you, my whole goal now is to be a service of people, whatever aspect that may be, whether it's mentoring them business-wise, alcohol, or whatever it may be. I wanted to take some time off after I had sold out of Bent Pixels and Paladin Software to just kind of work on myself, get myself right. But even that being said, what I do want to do eventually at some point is open up a rehab center. I've been toying around with this and doing a lot of investigating, a lot of due diligence of what that would take. And I have some friends, good friends here that are in that industry, but the first model we did just didn't work out. So I'm not pushing anything. If it happens, it happens. I'm going to let it organically happen. And, that would be an ultimate goal. 'Cause I just feel like the rehab centers around the country, obviously everybody knows they're like a 10% success rate, which is terrible. It's just like you're, and to me, I understand it's a business, but I do understand that what they're doing isn't working. So something needs to change. And I would run it a little differently with combining like this Eastern medicine stuff that I'm learning with breath work, cold exposure, and meditation, have more heavily into that recovery and not just don't drink, because that's pretty much what they tell you. Just don't drink, go to AA meetings 20 times a day and have no life. You know, that's not the way I think that people are going to stay sober. You have to integrate back into life. You have to learn how to deal with yourself. You have to learn how to be comfortable in a work environment. You can't just live at AA meetings. So this was my goal, is to try to somehow affect this rehab centers and to make them, you know, have a higher productive rate. I was like, if I could get it to 20%, it would be great. You know, just any positive influence is what that's what my goal is to accomplish.
Do you think, do you have the ability to take a podcast like this one and turn it into a freaking mega hit?
It'd be Welcome to Lost Marty, not Las Vegas. I'm kidding. Everybody's asked me this over years. It's like, how do you make videos go viral? If I knew the answer to that, you wouldn't be talking to me right now. I'd be off on an island somewhere. I'm joking, but that's the hardest thing to answer, is how do you make something become popular or take off? And there's certain ways to do it. There's a lot of ways you can change like the descriptions, titles, all those sorts of things on a YouTube channel you can do. But at the end of the day, the talent has to be there. There has to be interesting topics. And unfortunately, a lot of times, like, over the years, we've had people that want to have like medical, we have surgeries, we can do this. I'm like, that stuff is really cool and I love it and I'm interested in it. Put it on YouTube and watch how many views you get. You're going to get 136. Most of them will be family and friends. But now put a video of you slipping in your backyard on some ice and bust your head open, and it might be 26 million views. So it's very hard to try to figure out because everybody's trying to do that. Everybody wants to make a fake. Now you see all these fake videos that are like falls or whatever, and you can see they're staged. Everybody's trying to create these viral moments, and it's very hard. So for me, it's all about, you need to have, like for Joe Rogan example, why did he blow up? He didn't blow up right away. It was gradual as he became a better speaker, as he got better guests, as he became more widely accepted.
And he got on UFC, and yeah, he got on these, yes, other things.
Yes. But the podcast, though, it even when he was with the UFC, the podcast didn't take off right away. It just became, like, after about 4 or 5 years, it started getting some momentum and then just went nuts, because he just really has great people on his show. And he's just a good dude, and everybody relates to him. I mean, not everybody. I'm saying guys relate to him. People relate to him.
Well, that's my deal, bro.
Exactly.
So I'm Joe Rogan Jr.
Yeah, yeah. You never know.
I'm Joe Rogan too.
That's right.
What did he get, 100 million for his podcast?
It was more than that, I'm sure. But that's like, there's been 100 million, 200 million, whatever. And it's all a 3-year deal. So
what if he decided he didn't want to do it anymore?
He could, I don't know with the dynamics of his contract. I'm sure he's obligated to, if he doesn't, have to give money back, but I'm just hoping that he's at Spotify, lives out his contract, and then he decides that he wants to come back to YouTube, and I would be more than happy to work with him again. He's a great guy, great content. We had a great time, like I said, 10 years or so of working with him on his podcast. And that's one thing that our company can say, is that we didn't take him. We were working with a guy that didn't have a podcast to the number one podcast. So to have that experience of watching somebody do these things that he's did, for us, it's invaluable, because a lot of companies can't say they've seen somebody grow that way and how he built his channel and what he did. I learned a lot of stuff just watching how Joe operates, not let alone what we do in the back end, our small part to help him. You know, we did a very small, you know, part in helping them grow, but it is a vital part. Rights management are super important. You don't want people ripping off your content. You don't want people taking advantage of your content. And he was adamant about that. He's like, I don't want anybody stealing my content. And I'm like, I totally get it.
Which means playing the video or a clip of the videos that he produced, put up there, and then someone took it and did something else with it.
Yep.
And you don't want that.
Yep.
Because I always thought you do want that for the same purpose. Yeah. The other one where, like, I hope somebody takes my shit. Yep. And puts it on their channel and gets me 100 million views.
That's the way you grow. I agree with you completely. My philosophy is let it be ripped and pray it gets ripped. Hope it gets ripped, because you want people out there consuming it, spreading it around. Because my view of it too,
well, it's you, it's him in the video. Like, yeah, what does he care?
The only reason I think he really cared was he just thought he could drive all that traffic to his channels, where the rate is much higher for a CPM. So it's the price per 1,000 views. So he would want to drive traffic there. And that's what everybody's been trying to do for years.
But if nobody stole it, nobody would know who he was.
I agree. There's a fine line there. Would he have grown as fast? I don't know. That's up for debate.
Couldn't have. You know the story between YouTube and Vimeo, right?
No, I don't.
Well, YouTube came after Vimeo. Vimeo, who's bigger, YouTube or Vimeo?
Yeah, well, YouTube, of course.
Yeah, well, Vimeo started it. The difference between Vimeo and YouTube is Vimeo had one share button and YouTube put 8 share buttons. So like at YouTube, it was clear they wanted you to share.
Yeah.
Share, 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 share. Everywhere was share, 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 share. Where Vimeo had one share button and it was hard to find. Some people didn't share. So YouTube dominated because of the share button. So it's the same thing. Like, I want people to take Dropping Bombs content, go make funny parody videos, go make fun of me, go do whatever, like make little sound bites, do something cool with it. I don't care if it's cool or if it's against me, but take it and like freaking go exploit it. And now everyone will be like, because it's still me in the video.
Yeah.
And they're like, oh, that's the guy from, you know, Dropping Bombs. And next thing you know, now I've got millions of people. Now I'm going to want to control my content to where...
That's exactly where he went. See, because he didn't really want to control it so strongly until he's grown to be the monster he was. And I get that. Once you get that big, then you're starting to say, well, okay, the money's good and all that, but I don't care so much about the money, but I want to control my content more.
Yeah, and people respect him.
Yeah.
Like, dude, the COVID thing went on. Dude, as soon as I watched his thing when he got COVID, as soon as me and my family got it, I called up, boom, I want the antibodies. I want the freaking ivermectin. I want the freaking hydroxychloroquine. I want the cocktail. I want the glutathione push. I want all the vitamins and everything that Joe did.
Yeah.
And dude, ironically, gone. Like very, very quickly. Like I started to feel like, there's a whole story, but like my back started feeling like I was carrying shit all day. And then next thing you know, I have 103 fever and I can start to feel like shit. So instantly, thanks to Joe, I knew exactly what to do.
Yeah.
And Joe just set up, straight up, told everybody, here's what I did. Like, and then everyone came down on him. It's like, dude, Joe's just a stand up dude.
Yep. And you know, Dana and him are very similar in thinking, and Dana's the same way. He took all of those things. He shout at the top of his roof, you need to take these things. I got it as well. Some of my family members got it. He's the same thing. You take all of that stuff.
And why wouldn't you?
Yeah, well, you would if you thought it was going to hurt you in some way, shape, or form. But these drugs, a lot of times the perception out there in the public is that it will hurt you when it's not true. So I'm not here to debate that one way or the other. I just want to feel better. I just don't want to die. So my philosophy was, I want to take everything that I can to try to save my life. And I'll leave it at that.
That's right.
That's how I feel. And I think anybody should be allowed to take whatever you want as long as it's a legal drug and it's to try to help yourself. Who's to tell you you don't believe in whatever? It's your choice.
Yeah, I mean, last week someone walking around this office with COVID, I'm like, shh, dude, like people that still think COVID's not real, they're like, it's just the flu. Yeah. Guys, I had it. It wasn't the normal flu.
No, it is a normal flu. But again, I don't want to be scared of it and live my life and like we did for a few months. It was terrible.
Well, the media tried to scare us.
Yeah.
But I wasn't really ever scared of it except for the first 30 days. Because, dude, I was sitting here in Vegas and I saw them taking cash out of casinos. They've never done that in the history of the world. They shut down Las Vegas.
Yeah.
Never done that in the history of the world. I thought, dude, these guys are playing it. They don't want panic. So they're playing it down. I thought, we're in some big ass trouble.
Yeah.
I
could see how you would think that.
I thought a lot of people are about to die. I went home. I shut the door. I didn't want no one coming over. I didn't care who you were. If you were outside the house when I shut my door, then you're going to be outside the house. Because otherwise, why let certain people in if it's a, you know, big scary thing out there?
Yeah.
So for the first 30 days, dude, I went in lockdown. We were spraying our boxes. I wouldn't touch shit for 3 days. Like I was sitting there literally thinking, dude, this is going to get real bad.
I agree. I was scared of any inanimate objects going to kill me. I'm like, it's like, really? But you know what? That's what do you think? Because I agree with you. Sometimes the message out there is to downplay it when it's like way worse because they don't want to cause crazy panic. So you're not sure.
And then my little girls, like, they'd want to jump on me and talk to me. And it's like, you don't want them talking in your face anymore. Yeah. Why? Well, because they could be giving you COVID.
Or you could be giving to them.
It's dumb. But, you know, I'll tell you, I'm sure I don't want to say grateful for it, but you know, business helped me because a lot of my online learning blew up. You know, you can't get COVID through virtual training.
Yeah.
So it helped me in business, and you know, that allowed me to do other businesses, and you know, so at the end of the day, dude, there's a silver lining to every cloud, I would imagine.
Yeah, I agree.
So right now you're just taking it easy.
Yeah, I'm just right now still working on myself, just doing my thing. I still work with Bent Pixels. I work mostly with the UFC guys. We bring in on some fighters. So working with that angle, working with some of the DraftKings of the world, those type of businesses that pair well with those guys, doing some stuff, trying to get some ex-athletes some work too. So there's some golf tournaments and things that we try to get guys, you know, small gigs for, just anything to try to build a relationship with brands.
So how can the Bomb Squad help you?
I'm happy to be on here. You know, honestly, if anybody has content that they feel that they would like to monetize and that they have a channel and it's their content they own, you know, obviously you can reach out to us at Bent Pixels. We'd be happy to manage your channel. Our strong focus is we have almost all the esports teams from like FaZe Clan team with all those teams and all their players. So we did partnerships with the team owners, and then it incentivized them to then bring their players who were with all our different competitors. Our competitors at Bent Pixels would be like Maker Studio, who was bought by Disney for like $1 billion, but it was didn't quite get to be that amount. Full Screen, who was bought by AT&T, Broadband TVs, and out of Canada, they're another big group. Omnia Media, they have all sorts of creators from gaming to celebrities to whatever it may be.
Why Bent Pixels?
That was the founder of the company. His name is Mike Puzateri. He had started this company, and he was how we got together was Anthony Bonifazio is a local guy here. His dad used to be the VP of Zahara. His mom's one of the Kim sisters. So he's a cool dude. We played football in high school together, known each other forever. So me, him, and Mike got together. Mike had already had Bent Pixels as a company formed, and he was one of the very first Apple developers when there was maybe only like 100 apps. Now there's millions. And so he was doing like meditation apps and that sort of thing. And then we're like, well, maybe we could get together and use our know of people and celebrity people we know to try to build something more. And we did like Kevin Hart and Shaq's mobile apps way back in the day, like, you know, 12 years ago. And then realized that that wasn't a reoccurring revenue business. It was just one-offs, and there was no way we would ever be sellable or really we could make money. So Anthony, who was friends with a guy named Key Lee, who was the head of agencies for Google, which is head of all their sales for their New York office. He had like 3 of the top 5 sales in history of Google. Anthony was friends with him, and then he introduced us to the group, and Google owns YouTube. He reached out to some folks at YouTube and said, look, these guys have these kinds of talent. Would you want to bring them over to YouTube and give them the tools to build a network? And that's exactly what happened. We started out bringing Shaq over there. We had a Comedy Shaq channel that YouTube did $100 million. I don't know if you remember this, it was a long time ago. They gave $100 million to like 25 creators. From Tastemade to Shaq to all different people. They were trying to get celebrities, real talent, to put their content and make it on YouTube. But they knew this was mostly a marketing ploy, that maybe 2 to 4 of those 100 would actually make them money. But it just got legitimacy to the YouTube platform, and just the media attention alone was a lot. So we were part of that offering. And so we brought Shaq over there and he did Comedy Shaq, and it wasn't a big success. It wasn't something he was focused on. But the point is that opened the door for us. And then we started partnering. At one point when YouTube they didn't have restrictions on monetization that they do now. We had like 40,000 partners. We would partner every channel that we could. It didn't matter whether you made a penny or $5 or $5,000 a month. We just wanted creators. And then now we're down to probably like 600 just really solid creators. YouTube's completely changed since we started, and 95% of the channels don't even monetize on YouTube that did. So there's no point in having them in your network if they can't monetize, and all they can do is get you in trouble.
Yeah.
By ripping off content. But back to one point you said about YouTube is, yeah, they do want you sharing content. And the reason they do is because just think of how much more advertising dollars that is. If you can have Joe Rogan's one podcast on 10 million channels, and now you get to put ads on that, then they make all that revenue because they get 45% of the ad revenue. So they're like, we just need content. So they hope it gets shared. But what they say to Joe Rogan's of the world or movie studios is, hey, we can't stop people. We tell them not to rip off content. Don't upload it if you don't own it. But we provided you with this claiming tool, and you can get your team to go out and find these videos. So you have the ability to locate these pirates if they rip your content off. But it's not our job to do that for you. It's your job to do that. to police your own content. We're giving you the tools. So this was a big court battle and went back and forth.
Does everyone have access to those tools or just high level people?
No, only certain people do. YouTube gives a little bit more to certain creators that'll turn on Content ID. But like a company like mine, we can match seconds of a video. When you get Content ID to a regular creator, like just say if I was Joe Rogan, if they gave me that tool, it would have to match like 100% of the episode. And so pirates understand how to shrink the player, to speed up the content, to mix it in with other content, to hide it ways that that 100% match will never happen. So it's not a very effective way of finding the content because these guys are very good at hiding your content and manipulating it so that the software won't find it. Mm. But we have an actual team of dudes and we have the software that enhances the ability to find this content. So it's super valuable for our partners that they're like you, you'd want it monetized. You'd want it everywhere. Some guys want it brought down. Some guys, there's an individual channel that's using it in a malicious way. Take the channel down. We can issue strikes to a channel and actually take the channel down where it can never come back again.
All on YouTube,
yeah.
Not on the internet though.
Just on YouTube, yeah. We focus strictly on YouTube, but we do brand deals on Instagram and those types of things. But those, it, really the monetization for our company happens on YouTube.
Interesting. Folks, yeah. If you got a drinking problem, hit him in the DM. You want a million DMs?
I'd be
of drunks following me.
But I'd be more than happy to help anybody that needs help. I really would. I don't mind at all. Anybody that needs help and anybody out there that's listening that knows, has any ideas or has any way or ideas for me about helping people with recovery center or ideas to that nature, I'm open to hear ideas. Again, I'm not rushing into anything. I'm just kind of absorbing. I'm being involved in a lot of different ways around rehab centers to just kind of understand them more and how they operate. And So I'm just in that learning process. And if it happens, it happens, great. But I'm not going to force a square peg in a round hole. I'm not going to open up something that's going to lose money. It needs to be a business, but I also want to help people. So
that's nice. Folks, at Marty Cordova, just like it sounds, MartyCordova, Marty Cordova. You Google him, he'll come up a baseball Hall of Famer and whatnot. But he's also a businessman, lived a life. Appreciate you coming in.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
Go to bentpixels.com. Otherwise, as always, keep it real.